This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of His Excellency, George Washington, by Joseph J. Ellis, narrated by Nelson Runger, and directed by Timothy Reynolds. This book is copyrighted 2004 by Joseph J. Ellis. This recording is copyrighted 2004 by Recorded Books. In terms of world history, or at the very least, Western civilization, it can be said that few men other than George Washington so readily came to embody revolutionary ideals and came to symbolize a collective desire for emancipation from tyranny, the ultimate result of which was the reestablishment of democracy in its first true incarnation since the fall of the Roman Republic. In his penetrating analysis of General George Washington's life, from his early troubled exploits as a lieutenant colonel in the colonial Virginia militia, to his vital old age as America's first ex-president, incessantly entertaining, admiring guests at his estate in Mount Vernon, Joseph J. Ellis examines the forces, both private and public, that placed a quiet, well-mannered Virginian tobacco planter at the epicenter of possibly the greatest achievement of the Enlightenment, the United States of America. And now, His Excellency George Washington.
Preface. The Man in the Moon. My own relationship with George Washington began early. I grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, and attended St. Mary's Grade School, about 8 miles down Mount Vernon Boulevard from the estate where the great man once walked the earth. Because my school was so proximate to Mount Vernon, my teachers, all nuns, forced us to make frequent pilgrimages to the historic site where the spirit of America's greatest secular saint resided. Back then, the tour was less historically informed than it is now. I don't recall slavery being mentioned at all. I do recall being told that the story of Washington's wooden teeth was a myth. My first encounter with the notion that you could not always trust what you read in history books. I remember this clearly because the high point of the tour was Washington's dentures, which were encased in glass and looked to me like a really gross instrument of torture made of metal and bone. The only other thing I remember is the majestic view of the Potomac from the piazza on the east side of the mansion. Apparently, I am one of several visitors to Mount Vernon in the 1950s who remembers Washington's dentures on display, despite the fact that, according to official records, they were never exhibited for the general public until the 1980s. The staff at Mount Vernon cannot explain the discrepancy, nor can I. In the early 1950s, when I was about 10 years old, I was lying on top of a one-story tar paper garage with my buddies to watch the annual parade down Washington Street to celebrate the great man's birthday. We loved the occasion because it got us out of school and allowed us to view the bands from the aptly named George Washington and Washington and Lee high schools. My mother also gave me a dollar bill, big money then, to spend in those local stores promoting Dollar Day sales in honor of Washington, whose picture adorned each bill. All this was happening in the shadow of the city across the river that bore his name, where my father went to work each day, and where the dominating feature of the landscape was a massive monument to one man's memory. My point is that Washington was ubiquitous for me as I was growing up, an inescapable presence that hovered all around. But apart from the dentures and the piazza at Mount Vernon, Washington remained a mysterious abstraction. He was like one of those Jeffersonian truths, self-evident and simply there. And the beauty of all self-evident truths was that no one needed to talk about them. They were so familiar that no one felt obliged to explain why they merited an annual parade. Washington was more omnipresent for me than Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln, but also more distant. If you went to the tidal basin or the mall, you could read the magic words on the Jefferson or Lincoln memorial. We hold these truths to be self-evident. With malice toward none, with charity for all. But there were no words on the Washington Monument. Just graffiti scrawled on the walls along the staircase to the top. Jefferson, it seemed, was like Jesus, who had come to earth and spoken directly to us. Washington was like God himself, levitating above it all. Or, as I eventually came to describe him, Jefferson was like one of those dirigibles at the Super Bowl, flashing inspirational messages to both sides. Washington was aloof and silent, like the man in the moon. You might wish to regard the pages that follow, then, as my attempt at a lunar landing. The technology to reach the moon was not available when I was lying atop that garage on Washington Street. Nor was there a fully annotated modern edition of Washington's correspondence, providing access to every letter he sent and received, along with extensive editorial notes on all the major players, moments, and controversies. Now there is. To be sure, a perfectly serviceable edition has been available since the 1930s, and anyone wishing to pursue Washington's life and times has never been wanting for historical evidence. But the modern edition of the Washington Papers is the mother lode. All the scattered bits of paper in the family attic gathered together, catalogued, and classified. This massive project is complete except for the final 3 years of the War for Independence and the final term of the presidency, though the crowded character of those years will keep the editors fully occupied for longer than one might guess. Nevertheless, it seems fair to say that we now have at our disposal every surviving remnant of evidence that biographers and historians can ever expect to see. The great American patriarch sits squarely in front of us, vulnerable, exposed, even talkative at last. Are we ready to listen? This is not just a rhetorical question. For reasons best explained by Shakespeare and Freud, all children have considerable difficulty approaching their fathers with an open mind. Washington poses what we might call the patriarchal problem in its most virulent form. On Mount Rushmore, the mall, the dollar bill, and the quarter, but always an icon, distant, cold, intimidating. As Richard Brookhiser has so nicely put it, he is in our wallets, but not in our hearts. And speaking of our hearts, a volatile psychological chemistry bubbles away inside all children in simmering pools of dependency and rebellion, love and fear, intimacy and distance. As every parent can testify, initially our children believe we can do no wrong. Later on, they believe we can do no right. Indeed, in Oedipal terms, they actually want to kill us. For most of American history, our response to Washington in particular, and the Founding Fathers in general, has been trapped within the emotional pattern dictated by these primal urges. oscillating in a swoonish swing between idolization and evisceration. In Washington's case, the arc moves from Parson Weems's fabrications about a saintly lad who could not tell a lie to dismissive verdicts about the deadest, whitest male in American history. This hero-villain image is, in fact, the same portrait, which has a front and back side that we rotate regularly. It is really a cartoon, which tells us less about Washington than about ourselves. The currently hegemonic narrative within the groves of academe cuts in the Oedipal direction, making Washington complicitous in creating a nation that was imperialistic, racist, elitist, and patriarchal. While there are some important exceptions to the rule, the reigning orthodoxy in the academy regards Washington as either a taboo or an inappropriate subject, and any aspiring doctoral candidate who declares an interest in, say, Washington's career as commander-in-chief or president has inadvertently confessed intellectual bankruptcy. A study of the ordinary soldiers in the Continental Army or the slaves at Mount Vernon would be more fashionable. When not studiously ignored, Washington is noticed primarily as an inviting target for all the glaring failures of the revolutionary generation to meet our own superior standards of political and racial justice. This approach is thoroughly ahistorical and presentistic. But so, for that matter, is its opposite, the heroic icon tradition. We are back again to the rotating cartoon character. Or perhaps we ought to think of that alluring dockside light in The Great Gatsby, flickering on and off like some synchronized signal of our fondest illusions. How can we avoid this hyperbolic syndrome? To put it differently, once we land on the moon in the vehicle provided by the modern edition of the Washington Papers, how can we accurately map the terrain without imposing the impossible expectations we carried with us on the trip? Well, if we find ourselves being merely celebratory, or its judgmental twin dismissive, we should rub our eyes and look again. On the one hand, we should begin our quest looking for a man rather than a statue, and any statues we do encounter should be quickly knocked off their pedestals. On the other hand, we should presume that we are engaged in a search rather than a hunt, thereby avoiding the temptation to cast Washington into the ideological abyss where his modern-day detractors, the Oedipal contingent, would like to consign him and his legacy. Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was preaching rebellion to the next generation, once observed that the founders were so intimidating because their propitious placement in American history had allowed them to see God face to face, while all who came after them could only see him secondhand. Our goal should be to see Washington face to face, or, if you will, as grown-ups rather than children. I began my own exploration with two convictions and one question. The first conviction was that I wanted to write a modest-sized book about a massive historical subject. Two of my most distinguished predecessors, Douglas Southall Freeman and James Thomas Flexner, had produced prodigious multi-volume biographies. The monumental size of these projects, so it seemed to me, implicitly endorsed the larger-than-life approach toward Washington and recalled the wicked comment by Lytton Strachey about Victorian biography, namely that the interminable tomes had become an endless row of verbal coffins. This is not quite fair to either Freeman or Flexner, especially the latter, who never felt obliged to round off the sharp edges of Washington's personality or to make his biography into an encyclopedia. Let me salute both of them as venerable pioneers on the Washington Trail. In my judgment, and in part because of what they have already achieved, we do not need another epic painting, but rather a fresh portrait focused tightly on Washington's character. In that sense, the predecessor who taught me the most was Marcus Cunliffe, whose Washington, Man and Monument, though nearly 50 years old, has aged remarkably well. Cunliffe deserves a separate and special salute. My second conviction concerned the historical scholarship on the Revolutionary era that has altered the landscape around Washington since Cunliffe wrote. We now have a keener sense of the intellectual and even emotional ingredients that came together to create a revolutionary ideology in colonial America. A more robust understanding of the social and economic forces that drove Virginia's planter class toward rebellion. A more intriguingly complicated appreciation of the strategic options facing both sides in the War of Independence. A more paradoxical recognition of the incompatible version of the Spirit of 76 that exploded into partisan political warfare in the 1790s. Washington's life was lived, and his career congealed, within these tangled historical threads and themes, which taken together comprise a new context for assessing his evolution and achievement. Most significantly, the burgeoning scholarship on slavery and the fate of Native Americans have moved topics that were formerly in the background into the foreground. These themes can no longer be treated as peripheral matters. Coming to terms with Washington means making them, especially slavery, central concerns. I also began my odyssey with a question that had formed in my mind on the basis of earlier research in the papers of the revolutionary generation. It seemed to me that Benjamin Franklin was wiser than Washington. Alexander Hamilton was more brilliant. John Adams was better read. Thomas Jefferson was more intellectually sophisticated. James Madison was more politically astute. Yet each and all of these prominent figures acknowledged that Washington was their unquestioned superior. Within the gallery of greats, so often mythologized and capitalized as founding fathers, Washington was recognized as primus inter pares, the foundingest father of them all. Why was that? In the pages that follow, I have looked for an answer, which lies buried within the folds of the most ambitious, determined, and potent personality of an age not lacking for worthy rivals. How he became that way, and what he then did with it, is the story I try to tell. Joseph J. Ellis, Plymouth, Vermont. His Excellency. Chapter 1. Interior Regions. History first noticed George Washington in 1753 as a daring and resourceful 21-year-old messenger sent on a dangerous mission into the American wilderness. He carried a letter from the governor of Virginia, Robert Dinwiddie, addressed to the commander of French troops in that vast region west of the Blue Ridge Mountains and south of the Great Lakes that Virginians called the Ohio Country. He was ordered to lead a small party over the Blue Ridge, then across the Allegheny Mountains, there to rendezvous with an influential Indian chief called the Half King. He was then to proceed to the French outpost at Presque Isle, present-day Erie, Pennsylvania, where he would deliver his message in the name of His Britannic Majesty. The key passage in the letter he was carrying, so it turned out, represented the opening verbal shot in what American colonists would call the French and Indian War. The lands upon the River Ohio in the western parts of the colony of Virginia are so notoriously known to be the property of the Crown of Great Britain that it is a matter of equal concern and surprise to me to hear that a body of French forces are erecting fortresses and making settlements upon that river within His Majesty's dominions. The world first became aware of young Washington at this moment, and we get our first extended look at him, because at Dinwiddie's urging he published an account of his adventures, the Journal of Major George Washington, which appeared in several colonial newspapers and was then reprinted by magazines in England and Scotland. Though he was only an emissary, the kind of valiant and agile youth sent forward against difficult odds to perform a hazardous mission, Washington's journal provided readers with a first-hand report on the mountain ranges, wild rivers, and exotic indigenous peoples within the interior regions that appeared on most European maps as dark and vacant spaces. His report foreshadowed the more magisterial account of the American West provided by Lewis and Clark more than 50 years later. It also, if inadvertently, exposed the somewhat ludicrous character of any claim by His Britannic Majesty, or any European power for that matter, to control such an expansive frontier that simply swallowed up and spit out European presumptions of civilization. Although Washington is both the narrator and the central character in the story he tells, he says little about himself and nothing about what he thinks. "I have been particularly cautious," he notes in the preface, "not to augment." The focus, instead, is on the knee-deep snow in the passes through the Alleghenies, and the icy and often impassably swollen rivers, where he and his companions are forced to wade alongside their canoes while their coats freeze stiff as boards. Their horses collapse from exhaustion and have to be abandoned. He and fellow adventurer Christopher Gist come upon a lone warrior outside an Indian village, ominously named Murdering Town. The Indian appears to befriend them, then suddenly wheels around at nearly point-blank range and fires his musket, but inexplicably misses. "Are you shot?" Washington asks Gist, who responds that he is not. Gist rushes the Indian and wants to kill him, but Washington will not permit it, preferring to let him escape. They come upon an isolated farmhouse on the banks of the Monongahela, where 2 adults and 5 children have been killed and scalped. The decaying corpses are being eaten by hogs. In stark contrast to the brutal conditions and casual savagery of the frontier environment, the French officers whom Washington encounters at Fort Leboeuf and Presque Isle resemble pieces of polite Parisian furniture plopped down in an alien landscape. "They received us with a great deal of complaisance," Washington observes, the French offering flattering pleasantries about the difficult trek Washington's party had endured over the mountains. But they also explained that the claims of the English king to the Ohio country were demonstrably inferior to those of the French king, which were based on La Salle's exploration of the American interior nearly a century earlier. To solidify their claim of sovereignty, a French expedition had recently sailed down the Ohio River, burying a series of lead plates inscribed with their sovereign seal that obviously clinched the question forever. The French listened politely to Washington's rebuttal, which derived its authority from the original charter of the Virginia Company in 1606. It had set the western boundary of that colony either at the Mississippi River or, even more expansively, at the Pacific Ocean. In either case, it included the Ohio country and predated LaSalle's claim by 60 years. However persuasive this rather sweeping argument might sound in Williamsburg or London, it made little impression on the French officers. "They told me," Washington wrote in his journal, "it was their absolute design to take possession of the Ohio, and by God they would do it." The French commander at Fort LeBeuf, Jacques Legardeur, Sieur de Saint-Pierre, concluded the negotiations by drafting a cordial letter for Washington to carry back to Governor Dinwiddie that sustained the diplomatic affectations. "I have made it a particular duty to receive Mr. Washington with the distinction owing to your dignity, his position, and his own great merit. I trust that he will do me justice in that regard to you, and that he will make known to you the profound respect with which I am, sir, your most humble and most obedient servant." But the person whom Washington quotes more than any other in his journal represented yet a third imperial power with its own exclusive claim of sovereignty over the Ohio country. That was the Half-King, the Seneca chief whose Indian name was Tanacharison. In addition to being a local tribal leader, the Half-King had received his quasi-regal English name because he was the diplomatic representative of the Iroquois Confederation, also called the Six Nations, with its headquarters in Onondaga, New York. When they had first met at the Indian village called Logstown, Tanacharison had declared that Washington's Indian name was Kanatacarius, which meant town-taker or devourer of villages, because this was the name originally given to Washington's great-grandfather, John Washington, nearly a century earlier. The persistence of that memory in Indian oral history was a dramatic reminder of the long-standing domination of the Iroquois Confederation over the region. They had planted no lead plates, knew nothing of some English king's presumptive claims to own a continent. But they had been ruling over this land for about 300 years. In the present circumstance, Tanacharison regarded the French as a greater threat to Indian sovereignty. "If you had come in a peaceable manner like our brethren the English," he told the French commander at Presque Isle, "we should not have been against your trading with us as they do. But to come, fathers, and build great houses upon our land and to take it by force is what we cannot submit to." On the other hand, Tanacharison also made it clear that all Indian alliances with European powers and their colonial kinfolk were temporary expediencies. "Both you and the English are white. We live in a country between. Therefore, the land does not belong either to one or the other, but the great being above allowed it to be a place of residence for us." Washington dutifully recorded Tanacharison's words, fully aware that they exposed the competing, indeed contradictory, imperatives that defined his diplomatic mission into the American wilderness. For on the one hand, he represented a British ministry and a colonial government that fully intended to occupy the Ohio country with Anglo-American settlers, whose presence was ultimately incompatible with the Indian version of divine providence. But on the other hand, given the sheer size of the Indian population in the region, plus their indisputable mastery of the kind of forest-fighting tactics demanded by wilderness conditions, the balance of power in the looming conflict between France and England for European domination of the American interior belonged to the very people whom Washington's superiors intended to displace. For several reasons, this story of young Washington's first American adventure is a good place to begin our quest for the famously elusive personality of the mature man who became a monument. First, the story reveals how early his personal life became caught up in larger public causes. In this case, nothing less grand than the global struggle between the contending world powers for supremacy over half a continent. Second, it forces us to notice the most obvious chronological fact, namely that Washington was one of the few prominent members of America's founding generation, Benjamin Franklin was another, who were born early enough to develop their basic convictions about America's role in the British Empire within the context of the French and Indian War. Third, it offers the first example of the interpretive dilemma posed by a man of action who seems determined to tell us what he did, but equally determined not to tell us what he thought about it. Finally, and most importantly, it establishes a connection between Washington's character in the most formative stage of its development and the raw, often savage conditions in that expansive area called the Ohio Country. The interior regions of Washington's personality began to take shape within the interior regions of the colonial frontier. Neither of these places, it turned out, was as vacant as it first appeared. And both of them put a premium on achieving mastery over elemental forces that often defied the most cherished civilized expectations. Glimpses. Before 1753, we have only glimpses of Washington as a boy and young man. These sparsely documented early years have subsequently been littered with legends and lore, all designed to align Washington's childhood with either the dramatic achievements of his later career or the mythological imperatives of America's preeminent national hero. John Marshall, his first serious biographer, even entitled the chapter on Washington's arrival in the world, "The Birth of Mr. Washington," suggesting that he was born fully clothed and ready to assume the presidency. The most celebrated story about Washington's childhood, the Parson Weems tale about chopping down the cherry tree, "Father, I cannot tell a lie," is a complete fabrication. The truth is, we know virtually nothing about Washington's relationship with his father, Augustine Washington, except that it ended early, when Washington was 11 years old. In all his voluminous correspondence, Washington mentioned his father on only 3 occasions, and then only cryptically. As for his mother, Mary Ball Washington, we know that she was a quite tall and physically strong woman who lived long enough to see him elected president, but never extolled or even acknowledged his public triumphs. Their relationship, estranged in those later years, remains a mystery during his childhood and adolescence. Given this frustrating combination of misinformation and ignorance, We can only establish the irrefutable facts about Washington's earliest years, then sketch, as best we can, the murkier patterns of influence on his early development. We know beyond any doubt that George Washington was born in Westmoreland County, Virginia, near the banks of the Potomac River, on February 22, 1732, New Style. He was a fourth-generation Virginian. The patriarch of the family, John Washington, had come over from England in 1657 and established the Washingtons as respectable, if not quite prominent, members of Virginia society. The Indians had named him Town Taker, not because of his military prowess, but because he had manipulated the law to swindle them out of their land. The bloodline that John Washington bequeathed to his descendants exhibited three distinctive tendencies. First, a passion for acreage, the more of it the better. Second, tall and physically strong males. And third, despite the physical strength, a male line that died relatively young, all before reaching 50. A quick scan of the genealogy on both sides of young George's ancestry suggested another ominous pattern. The founder of the Washington line had three wives, the last of whom had been widowed three times. Washington's father had lost his first wife in 1729, and Mary Ball Washington, his second wife, was herself an orphan, whose own mother had been widowed twice. The Virginian world into which George Washington was born was a decidedly precarious place, where neither domestic stability nor life itself could be taken for granted. This harsh reality was driven home in April 1743, when Augustine Washington died, leaving his widow and seven children an estate that included 10,000 acres divided into several disparate parcels and 49 slaves. Washington spent his early adolescence living with his mother at Ferry Farm in a six-room farmhouse across the Rappahannock from Fredericksburg. He received the modern equivalent of a grade school education, but was never exposed to the classical curriculum or encouraged to attend college at William and Mary, a deficiency that haunted him throughout his subsequent career among American statesmen with more robust educational credentials. Several biographers have called attention to his hand-copied list of 110 precepts from The Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior in Company and Conversation, which was based on rules of etiquette originally composed by Jesuit scholars in 1595. Several of the rules are hilarious. Number 9. Spit not into the fire, especially if there be meat before it. Number 13. Kill no vermin or fleas, lice, ticks, etc., in the sight of others. But the first rule also seems to have had resonance for Washington's later obsession with deportment. Every action done in company ought to be done with some sign of respect to those that are present. As a reminder of an earlier era's conviction that character was not just who you were, but also what others thought you were, this is a useful point that foreshadows Washington's flair for disappearing within his public persona. But the more prosaic truth is that Rules of Civility has attracted so much attention from biographers because it is one of the few documents of Washington's youth that has survived. It is quite possible that he copied out the list as a mere exercise in penmanship. The two major influences on Washington's youthful development were his half-brother Lawrence, 14 years his senior, and the Fairfax family. Lawrence became a surrogate father, responsible for managing the career options of his young protege, who as a younger son had little hope of inheriting enough land to permit easy entrance into the planter class of Chesapeake society. In 1746, Lawrence proposed that young George enlist as a midshipman in the British Navy. His mother opposed the suggestion, as did his uncle in England, who clinched the negative verdict by observing that the Navy would cut him and staple him and use him like a Negro, or rather like a dog. Lawrence's two other contributions to Washington's future career were richly ironic. In 1751, he traveled to Barbados, seeking a tropical cure for his tuberculosis, and took Washington along as a companion. This turned out to be Washington's one and only trip abroad, and the occasion for his contraction of smallpox. He carried barely discernible pockmarks on his face for the rest of his life, but also immunity against the most feared and fatal disease of the era. Then, in 1752, Lawrence lost his bout with tuberculosis, thereby sustaining the family tradition of short-lived males. His 2,500-acre plantation, now named Mount Vernon, became part of the estate that Washington eventually inherited. Lawrence's premature death made possible his greatest legacy. The Fairfax influence also had its ironies. At about the age of 15, Washington began to spend much of his time at Mount Vernon with Lawrence, who had married Anne Fairfax of the Fairfax dynasty at nearby Belvoir. The patriarch of the clan was Lord Thomas Fairfax, an eccentric member of the English peerage whose disdain for women and love for horses and hounds soon carried him across the Blue Ridge to pursue his passion for fox hunting, undisturbed by the nettlesome duties of managing his estates. His cousin William Fairfax assumed that responsibility, which was a truly daunting task. The much-disputed Fairfax claim, only recently validated by the Privy Council in London, gave Lord Fairfax proprietary rights to more than 5 million acres, including the huge Northern Neck region between the Potomac and Rappahannock. The Fairfaxes, in short, were a living remnant of European feudalism and English-style aristocracy, firmly embedded within Virginia's more provincial version of country gentlemen. As such, they were the supreme example of privileged bloodlines, royal patronage, and what one Washington biographer has called the assiduous courting of the great. Though Washington was destined to lead a revolution that eventually toppled this whole constellation of aristocratic beliefs and presumptions, he was initially a beneficiary of its powers of patronage. In 1748, William Fairfax gave 16-year-old Washington his first job. He accompanied William's son, George William Fairfax, on a surveying expedition of the Fairfax holdings in the Shenandoah Valley. Washington's first diary entries date from this time, so we get our initial glimpse of his handwriting and prose, as well as his impression of the primitive conditions on the far side of the Blue Ridge. "Went into the bed, as they called it, when to my surprise I found it to be nothing but a little straw, matted together without sheets or anything else, but only one threadbare blanket with double its weight of vermin, such as lice, fleas, etc." The few settlers in this frontier region struck him as strange creatures who wore tattered clothes and tended to speak German rather than English. He also saw an Indian war party. Returning from a skirmish with one scalp and celebrating their victory by dancing around their campfire to the music of a kettle drum. If the Fairfax family represented the epitome of English civilization, the area west of the Blue Ridge represented the far edge of civilization's progress. Beyond that edge lay the Ohio country, where anything that Europeans called civilization ceased to exist altogether. The previous year, in 1747, Lawrence had joined a group of investors to form the Ohio Company, which obtained a royal grant of 500,000 acres to bring Virginia's version of civilization to that distant place west of the Alleghenies, where Washington would soon test his manhood against the elements in the name of the British king. For now, however, and for the next 3 years, he remained on the eastern edge of Virginia's frontier, surveying the Fairfax holdings in the Northern Neck and Shenandoah Valley, mastering his new trade by conducting more than 190 surveys, usually camping under the stars, doing well enough financially to permit his first purchase of land, a 1,459-acre plot on Bullskin Creek in the lower Shenandoah. Again, the historical record affords only glimpses of the emerging young man. There are pieces of adolescent doggerel about his poor, resistless heart, pierced by Cupid's feathered dart, perhaps a reference to an unknown lowland beauty that stirred his passions, perhaps a reference to his futile pursuit of Betsy Fauntleroy, a 16-year-old coquette who found him unacceptable. His name appears as plaintiff in a Fredericksburg court case, filing charges against one Mary McDaniel for rifling through his clothes while he was bathing in the local river. She received 15 lashes. Later on, women would swoon at his appearance, but at this early stage he struck them as awkward, even oafish, and paralyzingly shy. No full physical description exists for this period, but accounts from a few years later allow us to project backward to envision a very tall young man, at least 6'2", which made him a head higher than the average male of the time. He had an athlete's body, well-proportioned and trim at about 175 pounds, with very strong thighs and legs, which allowed him to grip a horse's flanks tightly and hold his seat in the saddle with uncommon ease. His eyes were grayish-blue and widely set. His hair was hazel brown, destined to darken over the years, and usually tied in a queue in the back. He had disproportionately large hands and feet, which contributed to his awkward appearance when stationary, but once in motion on the dance floor or in a fox hunt, the natural grace of his movements overwhelmed the initial impression. Well-muscled and coordinated, he never threw a silver dollar across the Potomac. To do so at the Mount Vernon shore would have been physically impossible. But he did throw a rock over the natural bridge in the Shenandoah Valley, which was 215 feet high. He was the epitome of the man's man, physically strong, mentally enigmatic, emotionally restrained. In June 1752, while Lawrence lay dying at Mount Vernon, Washington petitioned Governor Dinwiddie for one of the adjutant general posts in the Virginia militia. He had no military experience whatsoever, and apart from being an impressive physical specimen, no qualifications for the job. Here, the two major influences on his early years converged in their customary ways. Lawrence's death created an opening in the adjutancy corps, and William Fairfax used his influence to assure Dinwiddie that the young man was up to the task. as Washington himself put it, "I am sensible my best endeavors will not be wanting." Dinwiddie concurred, made himself Washington's new mentor and patron, then dispatched Major Washington into the western wilderness the following year. Assassination and Necessity. Over the course of the next 5 years, from 1754 to 1759, Washington spent the bulk of his time west of the Blue Ridge, leading a series of expeditions into the Ohio country that served as crash courses in the art of soldiering. They also provided him with a truly searing set of personal experiences that shaped his basic outlook on the world. Instead of going to college, Washington went to war. And the kind of education he received, like the smallpox he had contracted in Barbados, left scars that never went away, as well as immunities against any and all forms of youthful idealism. The first adventure began in the spring of 1754, when the Virginia House of Burgesses voted funds to raise a regiment of 300 men to protect settlers in the Ohio country from the mounting French threat. Washington was made second in command with the rank of lieutenant colonel. In April, he left Alexandria at the head of 160 troops charged with the mission of securing the strategic location at the juncture of the Allegheny and Monongahela, where the Ohio Company had already begun to construct a fort. Soon after he completed the difficult trek over the Alleghenies, Washington learned that a French force of more than 1,000 had seized the half-built fort, renamed it Fort Duquesne, and were proceeding to radiate French influence over the several Indian tribes in the region. The best intelligence came from his former companion and major Indian ally, Tanacharison, who apprised Washington that the situation was truly desperate. "If you do not come to our assistance now," he wrote, "we are entirely undone, and imagine we shall never meet again." Faced with a vastly superior enemy force, Washington decided to build a makeshift fort near Tanacharison's camp, rally whatever Indian allies he could find, and wait for reinforcements. Tanacharison promised his support, but also warned that the odds were stacked against them. On May 27th, Tanacharison reported the appearance of French troops in the vicinity and brought a delegation of warriors to join Washington's garrison at Great Meadows, about 40 miles from Fort Duquesne. On the morning of May 28th, Washington found a French patrol of 32 soldiers encamped in a forest glen that Tanacharison described as a low, obscure place. His detachment of 40, plus the Indian allies under Tanacharison, encircled the French camp. Washington's report on the action that ensued, sent to Dinwiddie the next day, was succinct. "I thereupon, in conjunction with the half-king, formed a disposition to attack them on all sides, which we accordingly did, and after an engagement of about 15 minutes we killed 10, wounded 1, and took 21 prisoners. Amongst those that were killed was Monsieur de Jumonville, the commander." His diary account, even more succinct, was also more revealing. "We killed Monsieur de Jumonville, as also 9 others. The Indians scalped the dead." What actually happened at what came to be called Jumonville Glen soon became an international controversy about who fired the first shot in the French and Indian War. It has remained a scholarly debate ever since, in part because it was Washington's first combat experience, in part because there is good reason to believe that he found himself overseeing a massacre. Though the eyewitness accounts do not agree, as they seldom do, the most plausible version of the evidence suggests that the French troops, surprised and outgunned, threw down their weapons after the initial exchange and attempted to surrender. The French commander, Joseph Coulon de Villiers, Sieur de Jumonville, though wounded in the exchange, tried to explain that he had come on a peace mission on behalf of his monarch, Louis XV, exactly the same diplomatic mission that Washington had performed the previous year on behalf of the British monarch, claiming sovereignty over the disputed Ohio country. As Washington sought to understand the translation of this diplomatic message, Tenacherison, who apparently spoke fluent French and therefore grasped Jumonville's point before Washington did, decided to take matters into his own hands. He stepped up to where Jumonville lay, in French declared, "Thou art not yet dead, my father," then sank his hatchet into Jumonville's head, split his skull in half, pulled out his brain, and washed his hands in the mixture of blood and tissue. His warriors then fell upon the wounded French soldiers, scalped them all, and decapitated one, and put his head on a stake. All this happened under the eyes of the shocked and hapless commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Washington. While he did not tell an outright lie to Dinwiddie, neither did Washington speak the whole truth about the episode. In his diary, he attempted to convince himself that Jumonville's claim to be on a diplomatic mission was a pure pretense, that they never intended to come to us but as enemies. In effect, he was rationalizing the massacre to himself. In a letter home to his brother, he glossed over the killings by focusing on his own personal response to the sense of danger. "I heard bullets whistle, and believe me, there was something charming in the sound." This self-promoting statement made it into the Virginia newspapers, prompting a flurry of stories depicting Washington as America's first war hero. The bravado remark even made the rounds in London, where no less than George II reportedly dismissed it as youthful bragging. "He would not say so if he had been used to hear many." Whether he was a hero, a braggart, or an accomplice in murder, the skirmish at Jumonville Glen had convinced Washington that his detachment, though outnumbered by the French forces in the area, could hold its own until reinforcements arrived. "We have just finished a small palisaded fort," he wrote Dinwiddie, "in which, with my small numbers, I shall not fear the attack of 500 men." He named the crude circular stockade where he intended to make his stand Fort Necessity, a glancing recognition of his precarious situation. In early June, Dinwiddie endorsed the decision to defend the fort, while also sending word that the commander of the Virginia regiment, Joshua Fry, had recently died after falling off his horse, making Washington the new man in charge with the rank of colonel. Yet again, another's death led to his own advancement. A British detachment of about 200 was also on the way to reinforce him. To his credit, Washington realized that his fate depended less on the British reinforcements than on the support of local Indians, who continued to control the balance of power in the region. On June 18th, Tenacherison arranged a council of Indians at which Washington responded to questions about English intentions toward the Ohio country. He apprised the several chiefs that the sole purpose of the English military effort was to maintain your rights, to make that whole country sure to you. He claimed that the English had no other goal than to recover for the various Indian tribes those lands which the French had taken from them. This was a bald-faced lie, rendered necessary by Washington's recognition, as he put it, that we can do nothing without them. Apparently, the chiefs found the argument unpersuasive, or perhaps they simply knew that the size of the advancing French force made any alliance with Washington's embattled troops a bad gamble. At any rate, Tanacharison led all the Indians into the woods, leaving Fort Necessity to its fate. Captain James McKay arrived with his reinforcements shortly thereafter, whereupon Washington and McKay began to debate command authority, McKay claiming that his commission as a captain in the British Army trumped Washington's colonial rank as a colonel. They could not argue for long, because by early July they learned what Tanacharison had probably known earlier, namely, that a force of about 1,100 French and Indians, led by Louis Coulon de Villiers, who happened to be de Jumonville's aggrieved brother, was about to descend upon them. On the morning of July 3rd, the first French soldiers appeared on the horizon, about 600 yards from the fort. Accounts disagree as to who fired the first shots, because Washington had only cleared the trees and brush 60 yards around Fort Necessity. The entire French and Indian force closed to the edge of the perimeter, took refuge behind trees and stumps, and began to pour a murderous fire down upon the beleaguered defenders. The result was a slow-paced slaughter lasting for 9 hours. A driving downpour filled up the trenches inside and outside Fort Necessity, rendering much of the gunpowder useless. By dark, nearly a third of Washington's force had been killed or wounded, and the survivors, sensing imminent catastrophe, broke into the rum supply to bolster their courage. Rumors spread within the garrison that 400 Indian warriors were marching to join the French, anticipating a massacre laden with trophies and scalps. The defenders faced not just humiliating defeat, but total